Please be advised that the opinions and views expressed by Richard Martin of GF Investment Services, LLC are entirely his own and do not necessarily represent the views of the company, its affiliates, or its officers. Investments based off of Richard Martin's comments are unsolicited by the company and are at the sole risk and prejudice of the listener and the investor.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. This is Richard Martin from Singapore on this 10th day of August 2012 with your regular diet of wake-up call. Well, I now have it that as of September, the wake-up call will be at 2 a.m. Oops, sorry, that's my time. 2 p.m. Eastern Time. That's Mondays and Fridays, 2 p.m. So, now you know. Well, last Friday, U.S. Congressman Dennis Kucinich introduced H.R. 6357, which is a bill which aims to, quote, prohibit the extrajudicial killing of United States citizens, unquote, by the federal government. In other words, in the land of the free, they need to pass a law to prevent the government from indiscriminately murdering its own citizens. Now, that's nice, isn't it? Now, if that doesn't give one reason to pause and consider the distortions of liberty that have taken place in Western civilization, I don't know what does. Think about it. Does a free society send government hitmen to eliminate anyone they perceive to be an enemy of the state? Does a free society have hundreds of police agencies, each with the authority to deprive a man of his life, liberty, and property in their sole discretion? Does a free society have hundreds of thousands of laws, codes, rules, regulations, and policies which effectively criminalize nearly every aspect of one's existence? Does a free society lead the world in prison population? Does a free society hunt down criminals and terrorists by treating its citizens like criminals and terrorists? Does a free society tell its citizens what food they are or are not allowed to consume? Does a free society steal your money at gunpoint to buy bombs that they drop by remote control on brown people in faraway lands? Does a free society debase its currency and plunder the purchasing power of its citizens? Does a free society saddle unborn generations with obligations they never signed up to bear? Does a free society award near total control of the economy, the money supply, and everything tied to it to a tiny elite few? Does a free society brainwash its citizens into believing that they live in a free society? At least the Chinese know they're not free. Ask yourselves, are you really living in a free society? Are you free? Well, if not, why not? What else could possibly be more important? It takes courage to answer honestly. But once you realize the truth and begin to see the system for what it is, it can be a liberating and life-changing experience. You'll find that there are places where you can live free in this world. There are ways to preserve your dignity, your privacy, your livelihood. You'll find that you can build great camaraderie and mutual trust with like-minded souls because you share the same values, not the same color passport. My guess is that some of you may have already started down the road to freedom, but you might feel alone, intellectually isolated in a sea of automatons. Well, you're not alone. More and more people are waking up every day and beginning to realize the incredible fraud that has been perpetrated against them. When enough of them figure it out, this system will be finished. That's why I fundamentally believe that today is one of the most interesting times to be alive. And we're just getting warmed up. If you have any friends or loved ones who still exemplify that self-deluded, bombastic surf mentality, I encourage you to have them listen to this section of today's wake-up call and challenge them to give you their honest feedback. It won't be difficult for them to access this. I have deliberately spoken about this right at the beginning of the show, so new people won't have to search very far into today's archive to find it. And for those of you who are listening to this for the very first time because you were encouraged to do so by people close to you, I have a message for you. If you'd never listened to any further wake-up call broadcasts, this is likely to be the first and last time you get this message until it's too late. So I encourage you to go back to whoever it was that recommended this to you and check in frequently with them for updates. Because I give you my solemn assurance that not one single person who got it, as they say, has ever come back to me to let me know that they decided that, after all, my message was not relevant. Well, maybe many of them did just slink away without saying anything, but the fact remains that nobody has ever told me that after coming to believe that things were as bad as I said they were, they subsequently changed their minds. Nobody. Well, the blindness of the economists and analysts who not only should but in fact do know better is breathtaking. There are economists like Kindleberger, Schiller and Rubini who have brilliantly documented and predicted various bubbles despite being scorned ridiculed by the captured mouthpieces for the oligarchs. But even these fine men have a flaw in their thinking. They can see speculative manias spurred by irrational beliefs and delusional thinking, but they are blind to the evil manipulations of bankers, politicians, and corporate titans. See, they believe that humans with Ivy League educations can outsmart markets, and through the fine-tuning of interest rates, manipulation of the money supply, and provision of liquidity through a lender of last resort, can control the financial system and avoid panics. Kindleberger understood the dangers, but still concluded that the Federal Reserve lender of last resort was a desirable entity which would be a benefit to the smooth functioning of the economic system and the people of the United States. Let me quote a passage from his book, Manias, Panics, and Crashes, and I quote, "I contend that markets work well on the whole and can normally be relied upon to decide the allocation of resources and, within limits, the distribution of income, but that occasionally markets will be overwhelmed and need help. The dilemma, of course, is that if markets know in advance that help is forthcoming under generous dispensations, they break down more frequently and function less effectively. The dominant argument against the a priori view that panics can be cured by being left alone is that they almost never are left alone. The authorities feel compelled to intervene. In panic after panic, crash after crash, crisis after crisis, the authorities or some responsible citizens try to bring the panic to a halt by one device or another. The learning has taken the form of discovering the desirability and even the wisdom of a lender of last resort, rather than relying exclusively on the competitive forces of the market. End of quote. Well, Kinberger's reasoning seems to be that since egomaniac busybodies in power always interfere in markets in order to convince voters they care, it is desirable to institutionalize the intervention. Booksmart academics always think they can outsmart the markets and correct the errors caused by the flaws endemic across all humanity. Well-meaning, brainy economists like Kindleberger, Schiller, and Stieglitz easily identify the irrationality of human nature in creating havoc with our economic system, but somehow they conclude that human constructs like the Federal Reserve tinkering with the interest rates, controlling money supply, and applying fiscal stimulus can be managed to the benefit of the American people. This is a foolish notion, and it has proven to be disastrous for the majority of Americans. It is, in fact, the very same human flaws that lead to booms and busts, which manifest themselves in the actions of bankers and politicians selected to manage and control the economic system. That's exactly where the problem is, and the need for a true free market method of dealing with human emotional inadequacy. The false storyline of democratic socialism versus republican free market capitalism is nothing more than propaganda talking points designed to keep non-critical thinking public distracted from the looting and pillaging of the nation's wealth by America's owners, the wealthy, powerful elite who have captured its political, economic, and financial system. The so-called solution to creating a private central bank has created more crises than it has prevented. And when you combine this lack of leadership, courage, and forethought with Federal Reserve governors appointed by partisan political hacks, you produce a deadly potion for the trusting American populace. You end up with spineless weasels like Arthur Burns, who was bullied into easy money policies by Nixon, the result being out-of-control inflation and a stagnating economy for 10 years. You end up with a once staunch proponent of a currency backed by gold, Greenspan, turning into a tool for the Wall Street elite and rescuing them from their folly and extreme risk-taking with other people's money. You get a former Bush White House toady like Bernanke, whose only solution to every problem is to fire up the helicopter and drop gobs of cash into the clutches of his Wall Street puppeteers. Whenever human nature is allowed to interfere with and tinker with the free market economic process, you end up with miscalculation, error, overconfidence, desire to please, self-interest, greed, and hubris. Those who scorn the notion of a currency backed by gold are believers in the false premise that highly educated, arrogant men are smarter than the markets and are capable of making the right decisions that will benefit the most people. These are the same people who prefer the actual results since Nixon closed the gold window in 1971. To be obscured, misrepresented, and ignored. In 1971, total credit market debt outstanding was $1.7 trillion. Today, it stands at $54.6 trillion, a 3,200% increase in the 40 years since there were no longer immediate consequences for politicians overpromising. Wall Street overlending, consumers overborrowing, and central bankers overprinting. The GDP of the U.S. was $1.1 trillion in 1971, with consumer spending only accounting for 62% and capital investments accounting for 16%. Today, GDP is 15.6 trillion, with consumer spending accounting for 71% and capital investment only 12%. Trade surpluses of the early 1970s are now $600 billion annual deficits. Total debt to GDP has surged from 155% in 1971 to 350% today. The illusion of prosperity has been built on a mountain of debt with an avalanche imminent. The truth is that human beings cannot be trusted to do the right thing. We are weak and susceptible to irrational and short-term thinking that now imperil our entire economic system. Did the gold standard prevent booms and busts prior to 1913? No. Since we are human, booms and busts cannot be prevented. Did the gold standard prevent politicians and bankers from making foolish, self-serving, short-term decisions that would have long-term negative consequences? Yes. A currency backed by nothing but the hollow promises of liars, swindlers, and racketeers is destined to fail. Gold functioned as an alarm bell that revealed the machinations and frauds of politicians and bankers. It can be trusted because it has no ulterior motives, no ego, no desire to be loved, and no plans to run for re-election. It is an inconvenient check on do-gooders, warmongers, inflationists, and Keynesians. And that is the very reason why it will never be embraced by either party or any central banker. It's true truthful. Kindleberger's fears regarding the moral hazard of rescuing those who have taken excessive risk have been fully realized time and time again. The maestro Alan Greenspan should have his picture next to the term moral hazard in the dictionary. His entire reign as savior of American crony capitalism was marked by his intervention in markets to prevent his bosses on Wall Street. His solution to every crisis was to lower interest rates and print more money. 97 crash, savings and loan crisis, Gulf War, Mexican crisis, Asian crisis, LTCM, Y2K, followed by Bernanke with the bursting of the internet bubble and 9/11. The Greenspan put guaranteed the Federal Reserve would always come to the rescue with unlimited liquidity to prop up stock prices. Investors increasingly believed that in a crisis or downturn, the Fed would step in and inject liquidity until the problem got better. Invariably, the Fed did so each time, and the perception became firmly embedded in asset pricing in the form of higher valuations, narrower credit spreads, and excessive risk-taking. The privatizing of profits and socialization of losses continued and accelerated under Bernanke. These helicopter twins talked a good game, but their game plan only had one play: print money. The Federal Reserve's last shred of credibility and illusion of independence has been obliterated by their increasingly blatant backstopping of a recklessly criminal Wall Street banks and secretive machinations with Wall Street politicians and foreign central bankers. Bernanke has lied to the American public, encouraged accounting fraud by Wall Street banks, overstepped his legal authority in purchasing toxic assets from Wall Street banks, been involved in the manipulation of LIBOR, screwed senior citizens and all savers with his zero interest rate policy, and used quantitative easing as a method to enrich Wall Street at the expense of the general public that bear the heaviest burden of higher food and energy prices. A few unelected bureaucrats and bankers use their obscene wealth to buy off politicians in writing the laws and regulations to favor them. Trusting them has proven to be a death knell for America. The captured mainstream media proclaims these men to be heroes and saviors of the world. when they are truly the villains in this episode. These are the men who unleashed the frenzy of Wall Street greed and pillaging by repealing Glass-Steagall, blocking Brooks-Liborne's effort to regulate derivatives, encouraging mortgage fraud, not enforcing existing regulations, and creating speculative bubbles through excessively low interest rates and making it known they would bail out recklessness. They have created an overly complex, tangled financial system so they could peddle propaganda to the math-challenged American public without fear of being caught in their web of lies. The country tolerates this through willful ignorance and laziness. They are soon to pay for their inattention and intellectual slovenliness. We are truly on the verge of an upheaval unknown in the annals of human history. All right, ladies and gentlemen, let me give you my information as always. The name is Richard Martin, and the toll-free number to reach yours truly is 888-874-4888. Eight. Again, that's your number, ladies and gentlemen, to call into the show, have your say, contribute to the proceedings in any way that you see fit. We are here for you, and the number again is 888-874-4888. And those of you who need to write as opposed to speak can do so by writing to my email address, which is open 24 hours a day, including during this very show, and the address is as follows: rm@gfawd.com. Again, that's rm for Richard Martin at gfawd for Global Financial Advisory Wealth Design .com. Once more, rm@gfawd.com. And finally, if you would like to call me in private, please feel free, call me on my direct line anytime. Leave a name and a number. If I'm not available, then I will call you back. And the number to call is a number in Sarasota, Florida, where my American office is located, at area code 941-441-1682. Again, that is area code 941-441-1682. All right, ladies and gentlemen, well, I believe we have some 2 weeks to go now until the next meeting of the Richard Martin Meetup Group in New Brunswick, New Jersey, and it will take place, as always, it will take place in the George Street Ale House in George Street, New Brunswick, on the 26th of August at 2 p.m. And please feel free to call Jack. He would like to hear from you, Jack Chavesta, and tell him you are coming. And his number is 914-414-6940. That's Jack Chavesta, who will be the moderator for the group of the 26th of August in New Brunswick, and he will have two people talking about their experiences with Johnny Miller at his convention in Guatemala a few weeks ago. And Johnny Miller, as you know, follows my show at 11 a.m. I don't know where he will be on the changeover, but I'm sure he will let you know. So anyway, those of you please who would like to come to the meetup group, please let Jack know, and so he can have a chance to prepare the room for company present. All right. So Murray Rothbard described the Fed's response after the crash of 1929, and I quote, "If the Federal Reserve had an inflationist attitude during the boom, it was just as ready to try to cure the depression by inflating further. It stepped in immediately to expand credit and bolster shaky financial positions. In an act of unprecedented in all its history, but repeated, by the way, after 2008, the Federal Reserve moved in during the week of the crash in October 1929. That's the final week of that month. And in that brief period, they added almost $300 million to the reserves of the nation's banks. Now, that was a lot of money in those days. And during that week, the Federal Reserve doubled its holding of government securities. That's the end of the quote. So you see, then as now, the big increase in money supply produced something that looked like a recovery, with the Fed doing, just like now, whatever it takes, in Mario Draghi speak, to save the world from the consequences of their own mistakes. And Rothbard continues, and I quote, "By mid-November, the great stock break was over, and the market, falsely stimulated by artificial credit, began to move upwards again." End of quote. Now, although that and the rest is obviously history, please note that the market subsequently regained, that's to say from November up until April of 1930, it regained 75% of what it had lost in the crash, and then it topped out 5 months later, and then fell 87% from high to low until July of 1932. Now, here's what's important to understand, ladies and gentlemen. Everybody, and I mean everybody, was fooled by the November 1929 to April 1930 rally, including Irving Fisher, the so-called greatest economist living at the time. Permanent prosperity, he talked about. A floor under the market. You know, that kind of drivel that we hear today. And all because, just like now, the Federal Reserve had plied the economy with money. But you never, ever read about that in the history books, do you? In our current episode, stocks have recovered from their 2008-2009 crash, just like in November 29 to April 30. So the banks, teetering on the brinks of collapse, were saved too, as the Fed let it be known that they would do, again, whatever it takes to spare them from the consequences of their own mistakes. And the leaders of this so-called rescue, mainly Ben Bernanke himself, are hailed as heroes, having saved civilization. These very men who caused the problem in the first place. Well, the 1930s had its heroes too. The first was Herbert Hoover, who had engineered rescue efforts following the Great Crash. And again, quoting Rothbard, "President Hoover was proud of his experiment in cheap money, and in his speech to the business conference on December the 5th, he hailed the nation's good fortune in possessing the splendid Federal Reserve System, which had succeeded in saving shaky banks, had restored confidence, and had made capital more abundant by reducing interest rates." End of quote. Well, we know now, however, that the heroes of the 1930s hadn't really saved the financial system from a day of reckoning. They merely postponed it and stretched it out. What, ladies and gentlemen, will we know about the consequences of today's folly? And, well, when will we know it? All right. Let's take our break, and I'll be right back. Okay, I believe we're back. And Let's start off this second half of the show talking a little bit about exactly why Greece, Spain, Italy, and Portugal, and so many other countries are experiencing depression-like conditions right now. Well, quite simply, it's because they have too much debt. And the reason they have too much debt is that they allowed themselves to become enslaved to the bankers. You see, borrowing money from banks can allow a nation to have a higher standard of living in the short term, but it always results in a lower standard of living in the long term. Now, I've talked about this before. I explained the fatal shortcoming of banks printing and lending money. When you print money and then lend it at interest, at that very moment, the moment of lending the money, you've just printed less money than you need to complete the deal. And that is because when you printed the money to make the loan, you forgot to print the money needed to pay the interest on that loan. Hey, you may say, no problem, let them just print the interest money as well. But think about it. That doesn't work. Because if you print the interest money, you have to lend it out into the system, and that immediately requires you to print more money to pay the interest on the new money you just printed to pay the interest on the old loan. Can't work, guys. You always have to pay back more money than you borrowed. Now, this is a game that ultimately nobody can win. And when you get to the point of having a debt-to-GDP ratio in excess of 100%, you are basically drowning in debt. Huge amounts of money that could be going to providing essential services and stimulating your economy are now going to service your horrific debt's interest requirements. The Greeks, Spaniards, Italians, and Portuguese are experiencing a standard of living far below what they should be because the bankers have trapped them in endless debt spirals. The vast majority of the people living in those countries have absolutely no idea what is at the root cause of their problems. Here's the grim reality that no mainstream media organ will ever tell you. No sovereign nation on earth ever has to borrow a single penny from anyone. Yes, that is absolutely correct, ladies and gentlemen. There is nothing at all stopping governments from printing up debt-free money and spending it into circulation. But that's not the way our world works, is it? Instead, our national governments borrow money that has been zapped into existence out of thin air by these ridiculous and totally unnecessary central banks. Ladies and gentlemen, I give you my absolute and solemn assurance. This makes no sense at all whatsoever. Remember, when I use the expression the Treasury, I'm referring to representatives of your elected government. The Treasury is the government. When I talk about the Federal Reserve, there is no government connection at all. Those representatives are not accountable to any human being within the United States. Not one. Oh yes, the chairman reports to Congress twice a year as a matter of courtesy, but it ends there. You must be wondering why governments don't just create the money themselves. You need to realize a very sobering thought indeed. If the government of Greece had been directly issuing debt-free Greek currency all these years, they would have had a national debt of zero today, and they would not be in the middle of a deep depression. Yet not a single person is proposing that they go to such a system. Instead, everyone is trying to figure out a way that the Greeks should muddle through this depression and keep paying on their unsustainable debts. And just like in Greece, the bankers have trapped your country in debt. The central banking systems of the world are designed to be endless debt spirals that systematically transfer wealth from the people through the government and into the hands of the ultra-wealthy. Just look at what's happening in the United States. The U.S. national debt is now more than 5,000 times larger than it was when the Federal Reserve was created. Until recently, I couldn't actually take you all by the hand and show you what happens when the system starts to unravel. But I can now. All you have to do if you want a preview of what is coming to your country is to observe what is happening in Greece and in Spain right now. Pay special attention when the mainstream issues reports of the horrors of life in Spain and Greece. Oh, yes, they will. Don't worry. You won't be spared the gory details. Because at last, you see, the situation is so bad that the blonde bimbos reading you your news can emote over horrendous pictures of poverty and social unrest because it sells advertising. It's news at last, you see. It wasn't before, when it was just boring old governments pontificating over this and that. Now you have people actually killing each other and breaking windows. Oh yes, now there's plenty of gory action for everybody. Wow, what fun. But watch it all very carefully, because it's coming your way. Which again, is one of the many reasons you might want to consider moving out. All right, well, I just received a link from Matt saying U.S. will not prosecute Goldman Sachs for fraud. I don't think he's going to prosecute anybody for fraud these days, frankly. It's not much of a surprise to me. Of course, the system they're saying now in Britain with this bank, which has just been brought up for Standard Chartered Bank, which has been brought up for doing secret deals with Iran behind the backs of the regulators, and the HSBC bank problems and the Barclays bank, they're saying there's some dastardly complicit plot to bring the center of finance and banking back to New York, out of London. And so they're trying to attack all the banks. I don't think that's true. I think they genuinely believe that these banks have messed with the system. But yes, indeed, apparently they won't prosecute Goldman Sachs. You know, the reason they give when you ask them why they won't prosecute these banks is they say, well, we just don't have enough evidence. And I must confess that sometimes it's true. I mean, I followed the situation in MS Global actually very closely, and it is a fact that they didn't have enough evidence to prosecute anybody. I knew that. I actually knew that. You could go along and you could ding the CEO of MS Global for irresponsibility and lack of attention to detail, and you can probably get into that. But the real big stuff, the fraud stuff, there's just nothing there, unfortunately, in the MS Global. Some of these other ones I haven't studied that closely, but MS Global was simply, as I always suspected from the very start, I said it was always really just basically a few sort of fat fingers just sending the wrong money over to J.P. Morgan for margin calls. It happened to be customer segregated funds. And I don't think they meant to do it myself. That is my opinion. I may be very naive, but I don't think I am. I've been in the futures business. I know that business very well. I'm not saying there's not other fraud elsewhere. There most certainly is. And countrywide is one of the most egregious examples of that. But you've got to be able to prove this stuff. I mean, I do understand that. And a lot of the time, these people have covered their tracks. They make it very, very difficult. So, and it's very costly. It's very costly to draw up the defense of, rather, the prosecution of this stuff. Anyway, I'm going to talk more about that in the future. But this year is the year of debt. The year of debt and immigration, as you know. So I'm really much more connected with that right now than before. Now, I do have an email here that came in, so let me see what it has to say. It comes from Sharon Lin, who says, "Dear Richard, do you think that a devaluation might be in our future? How have devaluations historically affected markets? Thank you so much for the info, Sharon." Well, Sharon, I don't think there will be a devaluation. First of all, we don't need devaluations in freely floating currencies these days because the market takes care of the valuations of the currencies, and the market really decides where those countries will be valued on a day-to-day basis. So I don't think that that will happen. I believe that when currencies do move in a given direction, then indeed you do have corresponding moves in other markets. And I do think that when the currencies fall and the dollar rallies, I think you will see the corresponding fall of the major stock markets of the world, including the United States. This is just a parity function which has no particular meaning, but it does tend to happen from time to time, Sharon. The trouble being, of course, that as soon as you have identified that and you've unlocked the secrets of the market in that respect, they go and change the locks. So I wouldn't depend on anything that you may think you have found as a panacea from making easy money. It doesn't usually happen that way. But the question is well taken, and I hope I've answered it. All right, well, let me see. We have another email from Anonymous, who doesn't want to be identified, so I shall not identify him or her. And it goes as follows. My father emigrated to the U.S. from Germany in the 1920s and experienced the Great Depression in Pennsylvania. When I was a teenager, he told me his generation would not cause another depression because of what they experienced in the 1930s. My father would not borrow money, only purchased in cash. Just before his death in 1962, he commented that the current generation was making mistakes his generation had made, and another depression was inevitable. What would he have said, observing uncontrolled growth of financial derivatives and our massive, ever-increasing, unpayable national debt? Having experienced hyperinflation in Germany, I believe he would have said our national debt would be repaid in drastically cheaper dollars. Well, that ties in a little bit with the previous emailer, but interesting observation there. Well, coming back to the question of whether there will be prosecutions. Did you know that over 99% of Federal Reserve Bank enforcement actions are resolved without admission of guilt? In a hearing recently titled Examining the Settlement Practices of U.S. Financial Regulators, various regulators tried to justify their practice of settling with financial firms and not requiring them to admit wrongdoing. In that hearing, Federal Reserve General Counsel Scott Alvarez stated that only 7 of the roughly 1,000 enforcement actions taken in the last decade were resolved without consent. The vast majority of the Federal Reserve's formal enforcement actions are resolved upon consent, which is fully consistent with the goal of resolving supervisory concerns with bank management quickly and firmly. In crafting enforcement actions that are entered by consent, the Federal Reserve typically sets out summary recitations of the relevant facts in whereas clause provisions. However, like our fellow banking regulators, it has not been our practice to require formal admissions to the conduct addressed in our enforcement orders, given the remedial nature of our enforcement program. Requiring admission of facts and legal conclusions as a condition of entering into a consent action is likely to have a deleterious effect on our supervisory efforts by causing more institutions and individuals to challenge the requested relief in contested administrative proceedings, which typically takes years to reach final resolution and which could delay implementation of necessary corrective action. In other words, the Federal Reserve will only punish banks who break the rules if those banks consent to punishment. Unbelievable, huh? This attitude is pervasive among all regulators. Here's the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency, which regulates, among other banks, J.P. Morgan Chase. Obtaining an institution's consent to an immediately effective order helps ensure that its problems are addressed at a stage when rehabilitation is still possible, thus helping the bank avoid failure. The long-standing practice of permitting the bank or individual to neither admit nor deny wrongdoing allows the OCC to get an enforceable order in place at an early stage of the proceeding and encourages compliance with the enforcement action and immediate correction of any deficiencies that need to be addressed. Because consent orders are made available to the public, requiring an admission of wrongdoing would prolong settlement negotiations and increase the number of respondents who choose to litigate the merits of the action. Of all the regulators testifying, the Securities and Exchange Commission's enforcement chief, Robert Kuzami, was the most embarrassing, announcing the SEC would be making a change to its practice of not forcing corporate actors to admit wrongdoing. In light of the special situation where an SEC civil action may also involve a parallel criminal action, senior officials in the Division of Enforcement recently undertook a revision of the neither admit nor deny settlement policy. While reaffirming the policy more generally, as a result of this review, the division, after consulting with the commission, modified its policy to eliminate neither admit nor deny language that could be construed as inconsistent with admissions or findings made in a parallel criminal proceeding. In other words, it seemed unwarranted for there to be a neither admit nor deny provision in those cases where a defendant had already admitted to or been criminally convicted of conduct that formed the basis of a parallel civil enforcement proceeding. In other words, if the company has already admitted guilt in a criminal proceeding where the evidence required is usually much heavier, then the SEC will ask the company to admit guilt in a civil proceeding. Kuzami spent most of the hearing talking about how the SEC was getting most of what it wanted out of these settlements anyway, without an admission of guilt. This is, of course, nonsense. Bill Black was asked about why it's important to make companies admit wrongdoing, and this is what he said. One, it demonstrates that what has occurred was a fraud. Otherwise, they deny it after the fact and insist they were simply being extorted. Two, the plea of guilty, as opposed to nolo contendere, can be used by civil plaintiffs and in admission administrative enforcement actions to invoke collateral estoppel. The defendant is estopped from denying their guilt in the civil action. This makes it immensely easier for victims to recover. Three, offenders, particularly multiple offenders, are treated differently under the laws and rules. the pleas could be used under RICO to establish a pattern of racketeering under the sentencing guidelines to secure a tougher prison sentence and to argue in favor of punitive damages and asset freeze orders. The hearing was about District Court Judge Jed Rakoff's refusal to sustain the Citigroup settlement with the SEC. What was interesting about it from a political standpoint is that all three witnesses, including the witness brought in by the Democrats, opposed Rakoff's move and supported the SEC's position. And one of the top Democrats on the committee, Carolyn Maloney, gave a long-winded opening statement in which she basically took the position that forcing an admission of wrongdoing was just too hard. In other words, many high-level Democratic politicians, for all their gnashing of teeth about the need for regulation, aren't being truthful. They don't actually want regulation. They want to be seen as wanting regulation. And the Republicans, while they want to be seen as the party against regulation, are actually quite happy having regulators they can work with, regulators who protect the banks from state or local level action. The argument over regulation or deregulation, in some sense, misses the point. We need regulation, obviously, but we also need strongly principled regulators. And neither Barack Obama nor Mitt Romney has any appetite for that. Well, I do hope that you have got some kind of an answer to your posting there, Matt. I did have this to speak about, and I was actually going to speak about it at a later stage, but I thought it was very relevant to this issue of not prosecuting Goldman Sachs. And frankly, I think it's a very interesting treatise on the attitudes of the government and the law and the SEC vis-a-vis all these issues. So be warned, ladies and gentlemen, you're not going to get a quick solution to any of these matters immediately. I'm afraid Frederick Pecora of the 1930s is very well and long since dead, and will not be around to help out in these matters. All right, let me very briefly approach the futility of money printing from a somewhat different angle from the way I've discussed it before. Now, I've said this many times before here on the show, but it bears repeating. It goes without saying that money printing cannot create a single molecule of real wealth. If it could, then obviously Zimbabwe wouldn't be a basket case, but a utopia of riches. Monetary pumping cannot be expected to produce even short-term improvements in the vaunted data. All currently existing economic activity is already funded. And it's important to realize that what funds it is not money, but real goods. Money is merely the medium of exchange that enables both economic calculation and the smooth functioning of the market. And let me give you an example. Imagine a very primitive island economy. Say that there are three fishermen who want to build a new boat to improve their productivity and hence increase their wealth. Building the boat takes time, during which they can no longer catch fish. They must, therefore, have enough food stored to see them through the boat-building period, otherwise they will simply begin to starve and then die, and they'll never be able to finish the project. If they hire additional helpers and pay them with money, then these helpers will also require food and shelter and so forth during the time it takes to build the boat. Unless someone else produces food in sufficient quantity to sell to them, or they have a big enough store available, the project will come to grief. In other words, an adequate pool of real funding is indispensable if such an investment project is to succeed. It would obviously not help at all if these men increased the size of the money supply. It is no different in a modern complex market economy. All economic activities require real funding in the end. The allocation of these inputs will only be rational when money is sound. Any interference with the money supply and interest rates by a central planning agency will necessarily falsify prices and paint a false picture of the savings and consumption schedules of consumers and the size of the pool of real savings available for investment purposes. It will therefore set bubble activities into motion, activities that fail to generate wealth because they only appear to be profitable. If no wealth can be diverted into such activities because the pool of real funding is exhausted, then all that will happen is that additional money will raise prices, but it won't be possible to conjure even a short-term mirage of an improving economy. So you see, ladies and gentlemen, that's exactly what we've been seeing. We've been seeing this kind of spastic addition of funding into the economy that's had no effect on the economy. So in order to see the economy for what it is, it's been necessary to look very carefully at the statistics, which people don't do. They simply believe the pundits that are telling them that everything is getting better. So it doesn't take rocket science to know that there has been no recovery, just more bubbles. And that's the way it goes. That's the way that the system wants you to think that things are getting better. Lies, prevarications, just malfeasance through and through. Well, ladies and gentlemen, I hope you've enjoyed our show. It's been a little bit more complicated than usual, but I've enjoyed bringing you the information, and I wish you all a wonderful weekend. Be back at you on Monday, same place, same time. Take care. Till then, bye-bye.